This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 14th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week I'm heading off for warmer climes. So instead of answering another cultural conundrum, I'm leaving you with a long list of holiday listening essentials. And funnily enough, they're all things that are featured on the Culture Show this summer. We'll be covering all sorts: sound art, biographies, product redesign, Spanish festivals, and even the Indonesian genocide. Perhaps that's not a particularly uplifting topic, but it's certainly a fascinating one when told through Joshua Oppenheimer's film, The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence.
I would get these boastful accounts in which the perpetrators would act proud of what they had done. And then they would invite me to the places they killed and want to launch into these sort of spontaneous demonstrations of how they killed.
So there we go. It's our greatest summer hits, all coming to you corker after corker over the next half an hour on this week's edition of Culture with Robert Bound. To kick things off, we're going to head back to our cultural guide of things to do, read and see this summer. On our holiday reading show, we heard from Arifa Akbar, literary editor at The Independent, and John Mitchinson, founder of Unbound Publishers, who had the skinny on the best books to read this summer. In this little excerpt, we'll hear John's picks of non-fiction that those of you yet to head on vacation might want to scribble down so you can enjoy them in a reclined position. I see that in front of you, you have picked up Skyphone, Mark Van Honecker's book. He's an interesting man.
Really interesting. He's a commercial pilot, but he's also, as it turns out, an astonishing writer.
Yeah.
But what he does is, you know that amazing thing? I thought this would be the perfect book to read on a plane. When you're sitting there, you're looking through your ice-fringed window out onto the world below.
And then you read the chapter which says, of course we spend most of the time asleep up in the cockpit.
Well, I've got a really good friend who's a pilot. One, I thought he'd love this book. But I talked to him about this, the fact that most of the job now is basically just pushing a few buttons. And in fact, planes land so accurately, they have to change the program to stop the tires digging runnels into the concrete. That's how most landings, I mean, who knew this? I always assume there's a guy up the front pulling backwards, you know, for all it's worth, but no. But he's brilliant about what it feels like, the extraordinariness, which has become, we've almost become denatured to it. We get into that EasyJet flight from Luton. We don't really think that we're in a, you know, we're in essentially in a tin can at 30,000 feet flying at 600 miles an hour. It is a miraculous thing that we do.
And Mark Van Honecker, I've read this book and it's a fantastic book.
Oh, great.
He demystifies and mystifies in equal measure. And that's the great success of this book, I think. Yeah. He's open to the magic of travel and of air travel, but also he makes his actual job sound very ordinary, which is quite selfless of him and kind of, it's kind of big-hearted of him.
Well, I'm a great, for my non-fiction, I like to read books by people, not exactly experts, but people who've done stuff. There are too many books by, you know, broadly columnists writing about things. Mm. I love it when you've got somebody who has spent a lifetime thinking and reflecting, as he has done, because he's a pilot. And you get a kind of an authenticity, but it's an added bonus that you get somebody, as far as I can see, what I heard on the radio, he can really write as well.
That was John Mitchinson, founder of Unbound Publishers, speaking to me with The Independent's Arifa Akbar. To hear all of their book selections, tune in to episode 195 at monocle.com. Next up, we're going on a sonic adventure. Back in episode 197, we explored how people appreciate sound art. And in this report, it seems that some do it from a train carriage. Sonorama, a new work by composer Claudia Molitor, has transformed one train journey into a work of sound art. The work is not merely a soundtrack for the weary commuter, however. Rather, it allows us to explore the landscapes hurtling past us in unexpected ways. Saima Tarek takes the high-speed Southeastern from King's Cross to Margate to listen to the view from the train.
We will shortly be arriving at Margate.
I was commuting a lot on long distance journeys, and I find it really an interesting place to actually think, because it's a place where you can kind of completely get out of your normal way of doing things. You're sort of trapped in this train. You can't really go anywhere. And you can just stare out of the window and let your thoughts run. And that's kind of very freeing.
Claudia Molitor is speaking to me over a coffee at the British Library. The composer and artist has been here a lot over the last 3 years, working on her new project Sonorama with historian David Hendy and contemporary art organisation Electra. A collection of sound pieces for the otherwise silent view from the train journey between King's Cross and Margate. Sonorama provides new compositions, archival sounds and spoken word essays relating to the social history and present landscape of the route. Involving a wide range of collaborators, including Guardian writer and classicist Charlotte Higgins, saxophonist Evan Parker, and poet Lemon Sisse, the work provides a sense of place for each leg of the journey, while complicating the stories from each site that the various sounds correspond to.
I thought, well, what's really interesting is that I'm looking out at this landscape rushing past really quite fast, like a film almost. And I'm sitting in this space that is actually quite static. And there's this real disconnect about what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to make a piece that deals with that disconnect?
To listen is to be straining towards a possible meaning, and consequently one that is not immediately accessible.
I thought of the actual journey as the score, and going up and down it, notating things of particular interest, and then coming to the British Library and going to the map department and looking at old maps from that area and just looking if there's anything that looks interesting and sounds interesting.
Sort of translated those histories into very beautiful compositions which punctuate the journey, and you end actually in this celebration of immigration
exactly,
using flutes from India and the Middle East. And in terms of composing for this journey, what were the challenges there?
The way you access is on an app, so obviously the quality of the sound files can't be enormous, otherwise they wouldn't all fit on an app. And then you're listening to it through headphones, and the train is loud and there are announcements. So you have to think of how does what you will be listening relate to those kind of sounds. For 16 kilometers of the journey, you're actually in a tunnel, and that's a very sort of different sound space. So I was very conscious about when those pieces would be listened to and what sounds would be around there. But you can play with these things and beautiful accidental things happen.
The diverse playlist that encompasses Sonorama not only illuminates the places it digs into, it also interrogates the practice of listening itself, at some points derailing the notion of what can even be defined as sound art. For that reason, it is a train trip worth taking. For Monocle in London, I'm Saima Tarek.
Thanks, Saima. And now we're going to talk about design, or redesign in this case. In episode 186, we discovered how to reboot a classic with design expert Professor Lawrence Zeegan. From books to products, we chatted about successful reinvention.
Weirdly, and I'm not sure if you knew this, but I've collected Coca-Cola bottles since about the age of, well, since I started interrailing as a student many, many, many years ago. So my rule is I bring a Coke bottle back from anywhere around the world and it comes into my collection. I don't know, 500-600 Coca-Cola bottles, all actually quite different. But the interesting story for Coke was that they meddled with the formula. They meddled with the formula during the 80s. There was such an issue with customer drop-off and complaints that they had to then reboot and call the original Coke Classic, and the packaging had to reflect that as well.
And the Coke bottle, people will maybe need a silhouette of a timeline of how this bottle has changed from, well, I guess the 1890s right up until today. What are the design touches? How much, for example, of Coca-Cola messed with that original design of the bottle? maybe less so than the interior of it.
Yeah, messed maybe not, finessed, but possibly if I'm kind. Amongst my collection, they produce commemorative bottles for particular kind of, you know, baseball World Series, etc. And you can, and the Olympics, you can understand why that happens. Where they've started to finesse, you know, the introduction of aluminium Coke bottles some years ago, 10 years ago or so, where they have messed, they've been very quick to turn that around and re-establish that, you know, the contour bottle. We all think we know that bottle, but when you look at, you know, 100 of them, there are huge variations in terms of the detail of the shape, the weight of the glass, the colour of the bottle. So it's iconic, but that iconic shape shifts.
And just generally, I mean, this can, we can encompass all of the things we've talked about, novels, records, making anniversaries for sort of classic albums, and product design as well. Are there tricks to updating a classic, to sort of rebooting a classic, that people tend to do? Can we see square corners getting rounder? Can we see uppercase going lowercase and becoming more like a URL, you know, a website address? Are there things that you can see during your career and studying and teaching this stuff, Lawrence, that you can see are leitmotifs of what we will call, with a small p, not a big one, progress?
Yeah, good question. And just the notion of rebooting, you know, rebooting, kind of restarting, or you shut the thing down and it's a complete brand new start.
Control, Alt, Delete.
Exactly.
Or just throw it out the window and buy a new one. Yeah.
There was the Museum of Packaging and Branding in West London. Fantastic place to go if you want to see the subtle nuances in terms of the kind of developmental changes that happen to a product. I remember visiting there a couple of years ago and seeing a display of milk tray boxes. And they showed milk tray boxes over about a 15, 20-year period. And actually, from the start to the finish, huge changes. But incrementally, annually, those changes were so subtle that the customers didn't see them happening. But they were kind of refreshing. They were modernizing. There were tweaks to the typography, the silhouette of the man all in black that would deliver this in the 1970s ad. He was kind of made more Bond-esque at one point. So I think the true challenges are in updating, refreshing, without necessarily your audience, your customers, seeing bold shifts, bold moves.
That was Professor Lawrence Zeegan chatting to me for our episode on How Do You Reboot a Classic? Earlier on in the summer, I was on a quest to find out how to write a biography. As part of the show, I sent our sole correspondent, Jason Struther, out to get the inside scoop on what it's like to write about the life of a controversial leader. He met Michael Breen, who wrote one of the first biographies of North Korean ruler Kim Jong-il. And here's how it went down.
The late Kim Jong-il was rarely heard speaking publicly, neither abroad nor in North Korea. So for most of us, this caricature of Kim from the 2004 comedy Team America is all we got.
Hans Briggs! Oh no!
That same year, the writer Michael Breen did what some might consider an impossible task, published the biography, Kim Jong-il, North Korea's Dear Leader.
I'm so lonely.
For three decades, Breen's been based here in South Korea and has traveled to the North seven times as a journalist. He never met Kim Jong-il, but came closer than most people ever did.
Yeah, the closest I got was I was in a small group that met his father. I did get a basket of fruit and flowers in the hotel room, which had a little card saying there from him.
Flowers and fruit, that's pretty sweet of the Dear Leader. Kind of makes up for all the bad things we've heard about him.
Ah, I think all heart, yeah.
North Korea is somewhat famous for its opacity. How does one go about writing a biography about a reclusive dictator and one that, yeah, you've never had the chance to sit down and chat with face to face?
That's true. I mean, North Korea is bit of an intelligence black hole, but you'd be surprised that there's a lot more. Once you start looking at a specific subject, there's a lot more information out there than you might think. One of the front lines of intelligence on him was an Italian chef who was hired to teach his people how to cook pizza. There was a Japanese chef similarly. In fact, the Japanese chef was the one to identify the current leader, Kim Jong-un. as the favored son. Then there are South Korean sources, there are defectors. I met one defector who'd been a fellow student, a friend of his at university.
How did you trust what they say about Kim Jong-il?
You need to have this sort of filter on to assess the value of what you're being told. Am I being told this because he thinks this is what I want to hear? Or am I being told this because is he exaggerating or is he minimizing, you know? So you try and cross-check things. And some things you just have to go with your gut instinct sometimes. This did occur to me at the time that the relative absence of information makes the job easier. You know, you need to use your imagination and powers of analysis a bit more, and you sort of go off on tangents a bit more, and you can come up with your own theories.
Now that more than a decade has passed since you published a Kim Jong-il biography, do you wish you would have done anything differently?
The publisher was worried that he would die. So I was kind of hurried along, which I regret, and so it was a bit superficial. It was intended for an audience of people who didn't know about him. It wasn't a contribution to the North Korea watching community. Here's some insights into Kim Jong-il. It was basically what everybody who knew about him knew anyway. So I kind of regret having agreed to do it so quickly. And I regret having agreed to limit the audience in that way. I'd have liked to have gone more into depth and found something more deeper, which I still think is there. We don't know the story of Kim Jong-il yet. The other thing a big struggle I had was, while I don't think he was an evil man, I couldn't really find any redeeming qualities. I found that I didn't like him, and that made the writing extremely difficult.
That was author Michael Breen speaking to Monocle's sole correspondent, Jason Strother, for episode 188. Be sure to stick around, because after the break we have an interview with a brilliant maker of Oscar-nominated documentary The Act of Killing, Joshua Oppenheimer.
We should have breakfast together, and lunch, and coffee, and cake, and a forced beer, or even an Aperol Spritz at sunset. And we know just the perfect spot. Come and join us at our London cafe that's just around the corner from our Midori HQ and also close to the Monocle shop. While you have a great flat white made with all-press coffee, you'll no doubt bump into one of our team and get to hear all the latest from the Monocle world. You can also pick up the latest issue of the magazine. Oh, and we also have space for hosting private lunches and events too. Join us at 18 Chiltern Street in London and also at our outpost in the Hankyu Men's Department Store in Tokyo. We look forward to seeing you.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and this week we're recapping the best of our summer shows for your end of summer holiday essential listening and my holiday. This summer has seen the release of some brilliant documentaries from Asif Kapadia's Amy to Crystal Marcel's The Wolf Pack. Back in June, I had the pleasure of meeting someone who helped us to answer the question, can documentaries change the world? Joshua Oppenheimer is the director of both The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence, the latter of which was released this year. Both films were about the Indonesian genocide of the mid-1960s, following the military overthrow of the government and the persecution thereafter of anyone suspected of being a communist. Hundreds of thousands were massacred and vigilantes roamed the land. Joshua Oppenheimer told us about the often uncomfortably candid nature of the protagonists and interviewees as they reenacted with alacrity the how, why and where of their killings.
Tidak, saya menganggap itu tidak besar.
Bagaimana mungkin tidak besar? 1 juta orang dibunuh atau lebih.
Itulah dia politik.
When I approached the perpetrators at first, I would ask very general, non-threatening questions like, what did you do for a living? Or what can you tell me about the history of your village? And within seconds, I would get these boastful accounts in which the perpetrators would act proud, and I emphasize act proud, I think pretend to be proud, I gradually realized, of what they had done. And then they would invite me to the places they killed and want to launch into these sort of spontaneous demonstrations of how they killed. And I had this feeling I was getting something much closer to performance than the sober testimony that we're accustomed to in films about atrocities. And performance is always intended for an audience. And my question immediately was, For whom are these men performing? Who's their imagined audience? How do they want to be seen? How do they want to see themselves? And what real image of themselves are they trying to dispel by insisting upon this heroic view of atrocity? And to understand that, I proposed to the perpetrators long before I met the main character in The Act of Killing, Anwar Kongo, I proposed to the perpetrators, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history. I want to know what it means to you and to your society. You want to show me what you've done. So show me what you've done in whatever way you wish. I will film your demonstrations, your reenactments, but I will also film you and your fellow Death Squad members discussing what you want to show, and just as importantly, what you want to leave out. And in that way, create a kind of new form of nonfiction film where we understand how you want to be seen.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the amazing thing, where even in the audience for that movie, for that film, you do wonder why these people are doing what they're doing, why they're acting out these things. And that is why perhaps those films, both of your films, have such a psychological depth, because you're always wondering why on earth the people on screen are telling you what they're telling you. Presumably one of the reasons as well, and this runs through both of the films, through The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence, is that the power structure is still very much in place, that they feel they have nothing to fear.
I think they have nothing to fear but their own conscience.
Yeah.
And I think, in fact, the way I understand the perpetrators boasting, and I came to understand this through 5 years of work with Anwar Kongo, the main character in The Act of Killing, who kept, again and again, he would push the dramatizations into more and more surreal territory.
He's like something from a Tarantino movie, almost.
Well, I think that you're emphasizing a little too much gangster and Tarantino, because actually he spends a great deal of his time proposing musical numbers. He equally could be out of a Busby Berkeley film. And those were his favorite films, the ones that he said helped him distance himself from the act of killing while he was killing, were Elvis Presley musicals, yeah. Not gangster films at all. But what he would do was, with him, I felt that his pain was close to the surface. And so I lingered on him, trying to understand, as I started to realize that actually the boasting is not what it appears to be at first. It is not a sign of pride. In fact, it's the opposite. It's a desperate attempt by Anwar and by the other perpetrators to convince themselves that what they did was right, because they've never been removed from power and never therefore been forced to admit what they did was wrong. You see, we always make the mistake of seeing people boast and thinking, oh, they're proud. But actually, if you think about it for 1 second, we know that when people boast, it's actually always compensating for insecurity. People do not boast when they're simply content and proud. They boast to prove themselves, sometimes to themselves, sometimes to you. So with Anwar exploring this, I would screen back for him the footage of the previous demonstration, the previous reenactment, and he would always look very disturbed, as though he could see the horror of what he had done. But never having been forced to admit what he did was wrong, he would not dare even say, this makes me look bad, because to say that would be to admit it was bad, what he did. And so he would lie to himself, lie to me, and propose an embellishment, an improvement, a change of costume, set, genre, as though if he could fix the scene aesthetically, he could fix his past morally.
Seandainya aku berbicara di era Orde Baru sama Bapak, apa yang akan Bapak lakukan dengan apa?
That was Joshua Oppenheimer, and his film The Act of Killing is out now on DVD, and The Look of Silence will also be available on DVD in October. Well, we're nearly at the end of the show, but let's end things with a bit of summer sun and music. For our festival special back in episode 193, we sent our Madrid correspondent to Barcelona to round up this year's Sonar Festival. Lucky old Liam.
It's been a long 3 days and nights, but while this crowd stood mesmerized by FKA Twigs, most probably didn't realize just how much work goes into putting on a show this big.
Well, it's big, it's gigantic sometimes.
I'm talking to festival co-director Enrique Palau, who's been bringing it all together for over 20 years.
Sonar is very diverse. It's a festival where creativity and technology meet, so this means you see a lot of shows, but also this huge Sonar Plus D Congress that is growing. There is a business section getting in as part of the content. So it's multiple angles. It's not easy to explain. It's not just a music festival. It's not just a DJ's festival. So there's many crossover situations between visual arts, music, congress activity, business, universities, workshops, all together, which for us is just a sign of the times. This is how we perceive life is today, through technology and creativity. So we, not just on the content, we feel that we need to evolve and change constantly as an event.
As Skepta and Jamie lit up the Red Bull Music Dome at Sonar Day, I snuck away to see the festival's more serious side, the technology and design focused Sonar Plus D conference. Of all people, I bump into Kickstarter CEO Yancy Strickler.
You've just come here to give a keynote address and make a huge announcement. Why choose a festival, a music festival, to do that?
You know, I've always wanted to go to Sonar but could never afford it, so it's a way to attend quite cheaply. But yeah, I mean, Kickstarter launched here in Spain just 2 weeks ago, and we did it intentionally around Sonar, just an event that embodies so many of the things that we personally care about, and also sort of what we aspire for Kickstarter to be, a similar congregation of music, creativity, design, tech. And so, yeah, I mean, it's an amazing opportunity to get to talk here, and then, you know, tonight and tomorrow night I'll just be out till dawn, so it's gonna be great.
So what about the artists? Well, the one person everyone had in their sights was A$AP Rocky, and fresh off the heels of a chart-topping new album at long last A$AP, he pulled one of Sonar's biggest audiences. In his only interview during Sonar, I met Rocky a few minutes after stepping off stage, where he was busy getting comfortable in his green room.
Can we get some candles in here, please? Can I get a candle?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
After personally orchestrating the lighting regime, he was eager to talk about the other revelation on his album, Joe Fox, a young singer who he found on the London streets at 4 a.m. and ended up enlisting him as a co-producer.
When I met Joe, I was midway through the album. You know, it's funny because a lot of people think that's him singing a lot of parts that I'm singing and stuff. You know, what I liked about him is he takes criticism, creative criticism, very well. He's always in student mode and he always is willing to learn. He didn't care that I was famous. I didn't care that he was a nobody. It was just I respected an artist, a talented artist, when I saw him. And I'm still prepping and shaping him to be the artist that he's bigger than anyone can imagine, you know?
Rocky also weighed in about Monocle's quality of life survey, and you'll never guess which city he's championing to get on that list.
Mayfair in London, just because the energy is so royal. On top of that, I love the way the architecture looks, the synergy and the chemistry. I mean, forget about it, but most of all, I just think it's amazing. Like, I just love it. I recorded my whole album there, you know? Well, I guess New York City architecture is similar to London in so many ways. You know, it just feels nostalgic to me for some reason. I can't explain it.
So that's what it is that attracts you to a city, just the architecture? Is it not, there's nothing else that you look for?
Nah, like I told you, the energy, the people. I love the cloudy gloominess. I love London, man.
For Monocle, for yet another edition of the Sonar Festival in Barcelona, I'm Liam Alders.
And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was a 24 hours a day, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week when I'll be poised with my magnifying glass, ready to resume my usual quizzical position. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.